listening to a very special edition of Capital District Progressive Radio, a two-hour edition looking back at the Communist Manifesto and at the history of American and world communism. And with us today, we have Greg Giorgio, the host of The Labor Show. And also from Florida, we have Sam Darcy, a former member of the Communist Party, joined back in the 1920s. Sam, are you there?
Yes.
That's great. It's wonderful to hear your voice after all these years of separation. I think the last time I saw you was, what, 3 or 4 years ago?
Something like that.
But we're going to spend some time with Sam because Sam has been involved in communism since the 1920s when he first joined the party. And I thought maybe we could start today's discussion by having you tell us a little bit about the early part of your life when you were a young man and how you first, or the first time maybe that you read the Communist Manifesto and the first time that you got interested in communism, and later on we'll work our way towards the present and try to understand what has happened to communism in all these decades.
Well, actually, my father was a worker in American factories till his 79th year. And he was a member of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union. And I was about 10 years old when he started taking me along to his local union meetings. He was in Local 35. And it ignited an interest in American workers' welfare that has stayed with me to this day, as a matter of fact.
Do you remember the first time that you came across the Communist Manifesto?
We had tried to organize child labor workers, and I worked in, when I was 12 and a half years old, I worked in O'Sullivan Rubber Heel Company in Lower Manhattan. And
that was around 1912 then, right?
About 1917.
Oh, 17, okay.
And
That's right.
We, from my previous couple of years in my father's union, I became interested in organizing young child laborers who were employed illegally laws which prohibited children working in factories below the age of 16. And we organized something called the Young Workers League. And I was about 12 and a half years old or 13 years old, something like that. And in the Young Workers League, we looked around for help in working out a program of improvement of young workers, actually child laborers, but by 19, this went on for several years, and I read a great deal of the literature of this, which wasn't orthodox, that is not accepted in usual circles. And one of the two of the things that I read, which interested me very much, one was the findings of Darwin and Darwin and other anti-religious groups, and the other was the Communist Manifesto. And I have never relaxed in my interest in the working people's welfare, American working people's welfare.
Now, back in 1917, when you were doing all of this, there must have been tremendous excitement at what was happening in the Soviet Union here in this country. Do you remember that excitement?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. See, there's a lot of wrong ideas about revolutions. Revolutions are not made or advocated or something like that. Revolutions, in 1937, I learned first how revolutions occur. I was in the Soviet Union the second time. The first time we were there to try to influence them to eliminate the unfair treatment of apprentices. For example, I was a carpenter's apprentice, and first year, you got no pay at all. Second year, you got 10% of the journeyman's pay, and so on. I was elected to, together with Harry Young of England and a man by the name of Lazar Shatskin from the Ukraine, to go to Stalin and convince him to introduce a more fair apprenticeship system in the Soviet Union. Actually, what happened was that I was chosen to present the case to Stalin, and I did. And he shrugged his shoulders and said, "Lunacharsky, who was the head of the school system in the Soviet Union, Lunacharsky, I had had meetings with him, advocating what we wanted, and he." He turned us down flat. He was against the school system training workers, giving them competence in employment and so on. He was for purely academic studies. When I presented this to Stalin, he listened very carefully and then shrugged his shoulders and said, "Lunacharsky is an artist and an academician, and there is not much you can do with those people." And so Harry Young and Lazar Shatskin walked out with nothing. And only later I found out that revolutions aren't something to play around with. You don't advocate a revolution. That's ridiculous. The old regime has to collapse, and if the old regime collapses, then the advocates of whatever measures are necessary get a hearing. In 1937, I was the second time in the Soviet Union, and as it happened, a the west point of the Soviet Union was in a place called Lafortova, or Lafortova, as they pronounce it. And I was invited to speak to their graduating class about the young people's rights and welfare and things of that sort. And the question arose as to who should go. There is a club of Anglo-Americans in Moscow, and they chose me as the person to go to Lafortova and speak there. When I went, I met a General Brusilov. General Brusilov has a very interesting history. He's an old Tsarist general, and he had the front against the Germans in World War One for the entire Ukraine, and he was the head of the Red Army's West Point. And I met him, and we got to talking about things, and he explained how the Russian Revolution took place. It was not planned or subject to advocacy or anything like that. But he said that the First World War, in the First World War, which began in 1914, by 1916, there were more and more reports of soldiers and officers in the Tsarist army leaving, sneaking away because they got letters from their homes that they couldn't bring in the crops or anything like that to take care of their families. And he said by February, the thing became a mess because they suddenly found whole divisions had disappeared from the Tsarist armies. And General Brusilov was not able to execute any government decisions. The Duma then took over, and the Duma under Kerensky advocated that first we must win the war, that is, first the Russians must win the war, and then they will improve the economic situation. Well, that was the exactly the wrong thing, because the first thing they had to do was to feed their families and take care of those things. And from February, when they took when the Tsar and his family ran away because they couldn't function any longer, General Brusilov was able to rally some individuals to go to Moscow and see what they could do. And the Duma, which is their Congress, the Duma took over under Kerensky. Not the communists. They call it the Russian Revolution, but the communists had nothing to do with it. The Duma took over. And under their theory that first they must win the war and then they'll correct the economics, didn't help any at all. And by November, the word Soviet simply means council. It does not mean communist or anything like that. And they had introduced a Soviet government, a government of councils, as by contrast to the royal absolutes of the Tsar. They would have councils. And actually, we have a kind of a Soviet government here. We have councils. We don't have any individuals issuing dictates. And the Soviet, the communists won the majority in the elections in October and took over. And that's how the Russian Revolution took place. Let me see now. I've wandered all.
Well, I was asking you about the feelings that were in the air back in 1917 when you were 12 years old and getting involved in organizing and in thinking about socialism and communism. Now, in those days, back before the Russian Revolution, there were socialist parties in the United States, right?
Well, there were socialist parties, and they continued. We got involved in the war in 1917,
mm-hmm.
and the Socialist Party was divided in sentiment, whether to support the war or be against getting involved in it. And Wilson, who was the president, had the very eloquent speeches about democracy and so on, and he won part of the socialist movement. And part of it was the left, what they called the left wing, which included the young people. We were against the war and our participation in it. And naturally, we read all the stuff that was issued, including the International, which you played earlier, and a great many other things, Lenin's writings, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to actually hear a few more versions of the International. Greg here, who's sitting by me, who is the host of a show that we have here called The Labor Show, wants to ask you a few questions. His name is Greg Giorgio.
Morning, Sam.
Morning.
I was interested to know, first of all, what was the feeling in a general sense among the workers that you were in contact with around the time of the start of World War One? Was there a what we like to call a class consciousness among those working class people? And how did they feel about, first of all, the war in general, and how did they feel about what was going on in the Soviet Union?
Well, there was a split amongst them. Even in the Socialist Party, there was a split. Some favored the war and some opposed it. And actually, the American workers were largely immigrants. And a lot of the immigrants were from the Slav countries. And some were Jewish, some were Christians, some were atheists, or whatever you might call it. And they split. And formed a left wing, which was opposed to the war. And Clinton and Wilson and his attorney general made raids and arrested all those who were opposed to getting into the war.
Right, those were the Palmer raids. J. Mitchell Palmer.
Yes, Attorney General Palmer, yes.
And, of course, there were some figures, for instance, Gene Debs, who ran on the socialist line, he was jailed, and, of course, a lot of the Wobblies were jailed, and there was also a split among the union folks in different organizations about whether or not they supported or would participate in the war. What's some of your feelings about what some of that was, some of that going on?
Well, in my father's union, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, there was a great deal of sentiment against participating in the war. And when the draft came, a lot of them wouldn't register for the draft. By contrast, for example, in World War II, my parents were pacifists, and they were against participating in World War I. But in World War II, in the war against Hitler, they sat at the door and cried, both of them, and made no objections to our going to register for service in the armed forces. So you have a World War I and World War II, quite different circumstances.
I guess, you know, you were very young when the war broke out, and do you remember the feeling among some of your other either the schoolmates or the working mates that you had at that time? Was there any kind of majority of opinion among the kids that you hung around with?
Yes, there was a division. The division went throughout the country, and the government took a very hostile attitude towards those who opposed the war, and arrested a lot of them. And once they got a ship called the Buford, if I remember it right, the Buford, and they put on it several hundred of the most active persons against the war, and instructed the captain to take him to any European countries that would accept them. And the anarchists and the communists and socialists and so on were very much involved in that.
Yeah, I understand, Sam, that after the Palmer raids and after the repression of the left in this country in the early 20s, that for about a decade or so, there wasn't very much radical activities in this country. It actually a time of affluence, booming business, and it seemed like, quote, radicalism was dead, end quote. Do you remember? And that's when you were getting involved in various radical youth organizations like the YCL?
Well, the YCL didn't exist at the time.
Oh, that's right. It was the Young Communist Workers, right?
The Young Workers League existed. And we were split same as the rest of the country, same as the other parts of the country. For example, in New York, the left wing was very strong, the left wing being those who opposed the war. And the socialists on that platform elected six members of the state assembly. And when they came into Albany, the State Assembly refused to seat them, accept their credentials, because they were disloyal, or I don't know what the exact wording was. And the six socialist assemblymen were never admitted, even though they were elected.
Sam, I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are in terms of what happened then with all the repression of radicals and communists and the different factions that were opposing the war and had a left-wing perspective, as opposed to what happened during the McCarthy period. Now, I'm jumping ahead here, but I'm just interested to know what you thought the impact was. Was it stronger in that World War I period then, do you think, or was it worse during the McCarthy period?
It was much stronger because the government initiated the anti-war, initiated the actions against those who were anti-war. And in the McCarthy period, McCarthy had a lot of support in the legislature and federal legislature, and he didn't have government action, and it made a great deal of difference.
Didn't Truman repress a lot of the left within his administration during that time?
Somewhat, not nearly as much as the Palmer aides were.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess we should mention the fact that during the Palmer raids, I mean, literally, these government forces used to go out and smash union halls and attack various organizations and party headquarters, and they literally would just go in and chop these places up, Sam, right?
Not only that, they did that, but they would raid homes and 4 o'clock in the morning knock on doors and grab the head of the family or whoever was on their list as opposed to the war, and took them off to prison. In one action, I think it was either Christmas or New Year's Eve, 10,000 anti-war people were arrested and imprisoned. And they would knock on the door, and the door would open, and they grabbed whoever they were after, charged them with disloyalty and all things of that sort.
You were, it must have been then after this period of time or through the 20s, it must have been very difficult to be a communist then in this country. How did the party survive? How did you exist within the party organization?
Well, actually, the party organization was illegal and met secretly in groups of 10. The rule was the group of 10. And they carried on propaganda and things of that against participation in the war. I was not really very... I was in the Young Workers League, but I didn't enter into party activity until 1929. And 1929... I was elected to be. We were looking for support from adult organizations, and the Young Workers League found support in the Communist Party, which in Christmas of 1929, I think it was, or might have been earlier, they held a convention in New York City and declared themselves to be a public organization called the Workers' Party. And the Workers' Party then entered a ticket in the elections and fought fought against the Wilson administration and so on.
This must have been, I think you meant 1919, because 1929 Wilson was long gone.
Yes, 1919. You're right.
Right. Okay. I was talking about the 20s in terms of the difficulty of being a Communist Party member. I know that in 1927 you went to Moscow, and you taught. I guess so. You were part of the Lenin School then.
I taught at the Lenin School. I taught American history at the Lenin School.
Uh-huh.
Uh, 1927, that was.
Right.
And sure, it was difficult, but we managed.
Uh-huh. When you got back, very soon after you got back, I understand that you were sent to California, and I thought maybe you tell us a little bit about what went on in California in the early 30s and your involvement with some of those struggles.
Well, I was first active in New York City. They had killed a union member, a clerk named Steve Katovas, in one of the Bronx places that was on strike, and a person came, a police officer came, and ordered them to abandon the picket lines in front of this place that was on strike, and they refused. They continued. Then he pulled a gun and killed Steve Katovas. And this almost brought a split in the party, because Browder, who had no idea about unions at all, Browder said to me, are you going to kick up a fuss like this every time a worker gets killed? Well, of course I was going to do that, because my father was one of the workers. And I came by it quite naturally. And in 1930, the leadership of the party... See, the first leader of the party was a man named C. Ruthenberg. And Ruthenberg had been a manager of a department store in Cleveland, Ohio. And he was a very gentle and compromising sort of a man who tried to avoid any splits or expulsions or something. But then he died, and for a few months Jay Lovestone became secretary and led the party, and then he wanted the party to pull out of the Communist International, which by then had organized. And instead, Browder was elected to replace him. And Browder manipulated to see how he could get rid of me. And at first, he appointed me editor of the Daily Worker. And
is that a way to get rid of you, Sam? To give you control of this, of the major organ of American communism?
That's what he thought. He thought I would get so involved in it that I wouldn't be able to oppose his policies. And Browder was really a corrupt man. He was everything evil in communism he championed. And they claimed that the International Labor Defense, which is a organization of lawyers, was in desperate need of someone to lead them, and that I was the perfect man. This is after I wrote an article. And I wrote and published an article in the Daily Worker in which I urged more reasonable demands by unions, which are negotiable, and which would grant a part of the union demands, even though they didn't grant all of them. And Browder was very hostile to that. He thought that I was betraying the American workers. I wasn't betraying the American workers. I was just trying to keep the businessmen in business and still get a break for the workers in those plants. And at any rate, they transferred me to the International Labor Defense, ILD, as they called it.
You were ahead of that.
I was the head of that. That's for right. a time. And, however, I was the real leader of the party in New York. And they came up with a story that in California they have been unable to solve their problems because they were organizing agricultural workers. And there's an area in the Southern California which is very broad, and a lot of the stuff that we get in the East comes from there. And they said that they need a leader, and suddenly Browder discovered the qualities of leadership in me, and he got the political committee of the National Committee to decide that I must go to California to rescue them. And so in 1929, in December 1929, I was sent to California. And organized unions, which was just my main interest, was to organize unions. I wasn't eager to put the businessmen out of business. I was only eager to get a living wage and abolish the humiliating what do they call it? The
factories in the fields?
Huh?
Oh, no! I'm anticipating a different direction. They were calling them factories in the fields, or the
no.
Okay.
The shape up.
Oh, okay.
Shape up okay. on the waterfront and okay. so on, and
right.
I got interested in that, and that was trade union stuff, and I organized it, and we won several bitter struggles.
Sam, I would be interested to know, were you serving as, in your role, going to California, were you serving the party as kind of a watchdog organization in California, or were you really, I mean, you said you were actually organizing unions. I guess I'd like to know a little bit more about how that goes about. Via the organization that you were in at that time. In other words, were the communists trying to organize communist unions, or were they trying to just get the working folks into other unions that they could build a force with in the long run?
Well, that's an interesting question. Actually, what happened was that there was a split in the national organization of the Communist Party between those who wanted dual unions, those who wanted to organize communist unions, and people like me who were in favor of organizing workers into the established unions like the American Federation of Labor and so on. And there's a long history to go through all the battles with between Browder and myself about this, but in California I won out in that we organized AFL unions under the leadership of Gompers and those organizations. And they organized dual unions in other parts of the country. But in California, we didn't organize dual unions. We organized a regular AFL union.
Now, was there a sense or was there an actual policy of trying to organize those unions along industrial lines, Sam, or was it strictly along the craft system of the separate locals each having their own jurisdiction?
Well, the latter was the prevailing method. We organized, for example, in the Siemens Union, in the maritime industry, they had organized in the East I've forgotten what they called it, some kind of a maritime union, Maritime Workers International or something like that.
Was that the NMU?
NMU, that's
okay.
It. National Maritime Union.
Right.
I'm glad you provided the name. And I figured this will go nowhere. And so we organized the union by... We kept the International Seamen's Union, the ISU, separately, and organized the longshoremen separately, and the workers who took care of repairing the ships and repairing them and all of that.
Let's see. Were those the mechanics, or I'm trying to think what. Was there? You're talking about a separate union for those folks.
Yeah, separate locals.
Separate local.
Yeah, separate locals, not unions, but separate locals. And
not the stevedores.
Well, the stevedores were all longshoremen.
Okay.
And I wish I could remember the name.
Yeah, I'm at a loss too. But go ahead.
And. We won. We there was a bitter struggle in which, like the clerks in New York, a cop came in and shot Steve Katovas. No one was ever arrested for it. And in San Francisco, a police car pulled up. Workers were lounging in front of. The union hall, just discussing things, whatever came to their minds. And a police car pulled up, and four cops stepped out and shot in them, and two of them died, were shot to death. And that was Nick Bordois and Howard Sperry. Sperry was... he wasn't even a left-wing worker. He was a member of the American Legion, and he got killed by our own cops, and no one was ever arrested for it. And
I guess, Sam, that this is a part of American history that we never learn. We certainly don't see it in textbooks, but we never even get a chance to discuss how... those of us who have tried to organize against for lack of a better term, the greater capitalist system are always the ones who have to pay the price. And then after we've paid the price, our legacy is hidden. Until we can talk to folks like you who remember it all.
Yes. Well, I was, as a matter of fact, I had worked at the waterfront all day, and then about 1 o'clock, I headed back to my office, which is at the Civic Center in San Francisco. And as I walked in, the people were all upset and excited, and said that told the story about the police car pulling up and shooting into the crowd and killing a couple of workers. And they said that danger was that it's going to become a gang fight with cops on one side and the striking workers on the other. As it happens, neither of those workers who were killed were even longshoremen. They were people in other industries, but they came to help the longshoremen. And I had to rush back and try to prevent this becoming a gang fight. And we did that by organizing a mass funeral the next day.
Now, Sam, was this in accordance with, was this a precursor to the general strike in 1934 in San Francisco?
Yes. See, the danger was that if we allow the answer to every cop, trigger-happy cop to kill a couple of strikers, the danger was it would become a gang fight. And so we had to do something to organize the funeral and so in a way to protest it. And actually, the chief of police, Quinn, I think his name was, said that he'll allow it if communists are prohibited from participating. He'll allow the thing. Now they reported that to the strikers and who were meeting upstairs, and one of the strikers got a tremendous ovation when he said, "Fuck the Sam,
you
chief,
can't, you
please.
Can't, Sam, you can't use that kind of language on the radio, okay?"
Yes,
and my apologies to the listening audience about that.
At any rate, he said that, and they got a tremendous ovation, and the cops were kept off the streets the next day, and we had a peaceful funeral, and we got by all right. Situation calmed down after a while. I tell you, you know what's interesting is that they accused the communists of advocating force and violence. Actually, that's ridiculous.
That's the pot calling the kettle black.
Yes. We spent three-quarters of the time trying to calm things down and getting a hearing for the grievances of the workers and getting a union organized and a hiring hall organized and things of that sort. I was later told by one of the lawyers, and his son is now a leading person. His name is, well, it'll come to me. Anyway, he was told that the customary thing was to wheel in the president, who was a whose legs were paralyzed, into the cabinet room where they were meeting, and they would all stand up, which was proper, and he would say then, ladies and gentlemen, be seated, and they all sat down and proceeded with the business. In this case, I had a previous Madam Perkins, who was Secretary of the Labor.
That's Frances Perkins.
Madam Perkins, what's her name?
Frances Perkins.
Frances Perkins, that's the one. Telephoned, and I was sitting opposite in the same the two desks, adjoining desks, in the strike office, and Bridges was on one side, and I was on the other.
Harry Bridges.
I'm
going to give all the first names, okay, Sam? You can give the second. But before I continue, this is WRPI Troy 91.5 FM. This is a special edition of Capital District Progressive Radio, looking back at American communism and world communism. And our special guest is Sam Darcy, former CPUSA, Communist Party District Organizer, National Education Director, a National Committee member, head of the International Labor Defense, and also active in the Communist International, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. Sam?
She was on the telephone. She called, and Harry took the phone, and she said, I could hear every word of it, she said, the president said that if you will get the workers back to work, he will give consideration to your demands. Well, that's ridiculous. The only weapon the workers have is to withhold their labor power. The next thing to do is to start shooting each other. And that was wrong. And I waved to Harry, no, don't do that. And he formulated it very well. He said to Madam Perkins, if I do that, they'll throw me out and they choose another person as president of the local. And how would that help you or help the president? And of course, Perkins reported that to the president, and he was furious with me. And Lincoln Steffens, who was a good friend of mine and one of the leading journalists of the time, told me later, the president would like to meet you and talk to you. And I figured, if I go to the president, to the White House, and talk to the president, he's going to give me a scolding lecture, and I'll leave with nothing. So I didn't go, and he was furious about that. And in the end, of course, what he achieved was the governor, Governor Jim Ralph, appointed a juridical committee, I don't know what you would call it, to hear the demands of the workers and render a compromise decision. And finally, in one of the towns, I can't remember the name of which town it was, this juridical committee was listening to complaints of the workers and so on. They were taking evidence, And I wasn't a member of the union, and so just to be present, I sat amongst the audience, and one of the members of the this juridical committee, Archbishop Hanna, who is a Catholic, head of the Catholic Church, came down from the platform. He not only knew what was going on in heaven, but he knew what was going on earth. And he pointed to me and he said, "Come out to the aisle." And I came out, and he said, he put his arm around my shoulders and said, "Mr. Darcy, you and I are fighting for the same thing."
That's a fascinating story. I take it, since you raised that story up, I mean, there's been a lot of tension between American communists and communists in general and the religious community. Maybe you can address some of those issues and some of the...
Before you do,
I want to start announcing our phone number so that if there are questioners out there who are interested in asking you questions, they can call in. And our number is 518-276-6249. Today we're taking calls on the 49 number. 276-6249. This is WRPI Troy. Okay, now Sam.
As it happens, my closest friend in California was Leo Gallagher, who not only graduated the Catholic school in Innsbruck, I think it was, was ordained a minister by appointment from the Pope, but I was against all that anti-religious stuff. I didn't see what the hell the... We didn't know the beginnings of the people who were atheists didn't know any more than the people who wrote the Genesis. There's no point in getting involved into a big debate over that question.
So you didn't waste time with that, Sam. You felt that was a non-issue, but it obviously was an issue among a lot of other American communists, wasn't it?
Sure, it was an issue. They thought I was deserting to the Pope. But I loved Archbishop Hanna, and I mean, as a result of this, and the final decision of this juridical committee was they granted a hiring hall, and they granted an increase in wages and other things like that. And we won that strike.
Sam, I'd be interested to know about that that general strike. Well, what was the... Was there a coalition of unions and maybe some other organizations like yours that were working for these to win these rights? Was it just the waterfront unions? Who else was involved?
Well, at first it was just the local union of longshoremen, and then all the crafts came out. And the Seamen's Union finally came out. I was part of a boat that, as the ships came into port, we boarded the ships and talked to the men and got them to tie the ship up and join the strike. After the shooting of Bordeaux and the other chap, there was a big battle on the waterfront in one of the I think they called it Hunter's Hill or something like that, there was several acts of violence, And I was afraid that it would get out of hand. As long as it was once in several weeks, that was one thing. But to let it degenerate into a gang war, that is another thing. And so I advocated compromise, accepting the finding of the board that was appointed by the governor. Incidentally, I knew the governor. My brother-in-law, quite by accident, was secretary of the railroad lobby, and it was the Southern Pacific Railroad. And one day, and he used to tell me about what the governor was saying. And I liked the governor. He was a clown. He didn't have much savvy about working people and so on. But he wore a cowboy boots and a 10-gallon hat and the Jim Ralph and things of that sort. And one time, I used to take a haircut in a barber shop around the bend from the Civic Center. My office was on the Civic Center, and as I came into the barber shop, there was a very familiar-looking guy. In those days, they used to shave you as well, and he had a hot towel across his face, and he looked very familiar. And I took a chair next to him, to get a haircut. And the towel was removed from his face, and it was the governor who was getting shaved. And he said this to me, "Sam, I'll wait for you if you will hurry and get your hair cut." So this was in 32. I'm pretty sure it was 32. 1932. And when I was through, the two of us went out. Now, in San Francisco, it never snows, at least almost never. And from September to February, it rains a good deal, and there's a cold chill in the air. And the governor and I were walking back to the Civic Center, and he kept pushing me, elbowing me to one of the buildings, and I wondered why. And we finally got to a door that was open, and we went into the hall, and I was wondering, what the hell is he up to? And he pulled out a bottle of whiskey. This was during Prohibition time. And he pulled out a bottle of a flask, I would say, a flask of whiskey. And he said, "Let's get the chill out of the air." And the governor of one of the biggest states in the country in Prohibition time was treating me to a slug of whiskey. So I knew him, and we were friends. When Jack, my brother-in-law, came next day to dinner at our house, Jack said, I told him this story. He said, we have a boat that goes from San Francisco to Vancouver. And when they come back with several boxes of booze. And the governor always gets one of the boxes. This is the governor of one of the biggest states violating the law.
I guess that's no surprise, but I'm glad he shared a little belt with you there, Sam.
Yes. He gave me I was a prohibition baby. I never had a drink in my life until then. But he gave me the flask. Four Roses. The name of the whiskey was, I still remember, it made such an impression on me. Four Roses Whiskey.
All right. And this is not an advertisement. This is a non-commercial radio station. No, this is you're listening to WRPI Troy 91.5 FM. This is a special edition of Capital District Progressive Radio. We're having a conversation with Sam Darcy about American communism. And Sam, I thought maybe we can step back a bit, and we've been going in quite in some detail over the 1920s and 30s, but maybe we can look back. I mean, I know there have been moments in American history when it seemed like revolution was right around the corner. The Depression was one such period of time, and yet there was no revolution. The New Deal came, and the New Deal seemed to have preempted whatever revolutionary fervor existed in the nation, and there were other moments in American history. Do you think that the Communist Manifesto and the communist ideal remains a viable ideal today?
Well, it wasn't viable then either. I have to tell you, revolutions are not subject to advocacy or playing around with them or something like that. It's only, like Brosilyov told me, when the government collapses and it reaches a point that it cannot continue, then a revolution takes place. It can't take place as long as the old regime can operate and have its decisions executed. And a lot of talk about revolution, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just talk.
Maybe I should go into it. Maybe I should phrase the question a little differently. Now, revolutions have a long course to them. In many ways, the Russian Revolution never ended. It began in 1917, and then the Soviet Union went through a lot of five-year plans and experimentation with, once you have a revolution, what type of society can you construct, and what type of society can be viable with the socialist ideal? And now looking back, maybe you can comment about what the evolution of socialism in the Soviet Union, and give us your perspective on what went wrong after the revolution.
Well, there surely was something wrong with the theory of revolution in communist circles. Many believe that it is a question of advocacy, but that's ridiculous. And no less a person than Stalin explained that to me. A revolution takes place when the old regime is unable to function effectively and can't execute its decisions, especially to satisfy the needs of the people. Let me see how to formulate this. Changes in, incidentally, I started on the Soviets, the February Revolution, the communists didn't even participate. 1917. It was Brasiliev who explained to me that the Duma took over, and the Duma being their Congress, and Kerensky, who headed it, advocated first we win the war against Germany and then we'll solve the internal problems. Well, that's as stupid as advocating a revolution. It's only when the old regime fails to execute its decisions and is unable to operate, that a revolution takes place. And nobody knew that better than Stalin, who participated in every phase of the Russian Revolution. But the Kerensky government introduced the word Soviet, which was a council. The word Soviet in Russian means council, C-O-U-N-C-I-L, a council form of government. In other words, not by individual dictator decrees, but a democracy. And Kerensky introduced that. And in the October elections, the following period of the same year, 1917, see, Lenin was in Switzerland. And when he came back in July, the communists found a leader. In the end, they won the elections to the councils. in October 25th, when the Russian Revolution took place, our period is November 7th, I think. When the communists took over, it's because they won a majority in the Soviet elections, and they took power because they won a majority.
But Sam, I guess I'm asking a different question, and that is maybe I'll rephrase it. That is, we've looked at several communist revolutions and communist societies and cultures in the 20th century. And in the public mind, they are always identified with authoritarianism. Is that the necessary course of a communist revolution? Is that what Marx had in mind when he published the Communist Manifesto in 1848?
Well, I tell you, Marx was an economist. Let's get the measure of Marx properly. Marx was an economist. When he was asked what form would the political structure take place under socialism, he said, "You're asking me for recipes for the cook shops of the future." That's his exact words, as reported by Liebknecht's memoirs. And Marx was not a political scientist. That is, he wasn't ultimately a political scientist, a separate story. He didn't live long enough. And he made a mistake. I hesitate to say that, but he was, after all, a genius in economics. But he made a mistake in the Communist Manifesto when he said, just blatantly, the working class have no nationality or no national interest or something like that. I don't have the Communist Manifesto in front of me, so I can't give you the exact wording. But that was a mistake, because it has since been shown that nation and Stalin knew that. I don't know if Lenin knew that, but Lenin introduced Stalin as our expert on the state, so it may be he knew that. That Marx made a mistake in writing a sloppy sentence like that. that the working class has no, the working class has a nation's.
But wasn't that a statement of hope rather than a descriptive statement?
Yes, I mean, in my book, published in 1972, that's what I treated it as, a statement of hope. But it's not like Stalin to present a fact in a sentence as hope. He was a pretty close writer. He measured every sentence very carefully, and he was careless in writing that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you're quite right that my opinion is that it was a question of hope.
Let me remind people, our number here is 518-276-6249. Our apologies to the person who called and wasn't able to connect. This is WRPI Troy 91.5 FM, a special edition of Capital District Progressive Radio with myself, Jerry Zahavi, Greg Giorgio, host of The Labor Show, and Sam Darcy from Margate, Florida, talking to us, a former member of the Communist Party, a member of the National Committee, and active in the Communist International, and we're talking about American communism and on this 150th anniversary of the Communist Manifesto. And we're now talking about the nature of communism in the 20th century, whether it necessarily has to be an authoritarian system or whether there are other directions that communism and socialism can take. And maybe we can pursue that, Sam.
I have something I want to say.
Great.
After World War II, the whole communist world made a very bad mistake. The Russians, of course, defeated Hitler. But in the countries that defeated him, they installed regimes which were an exact copy of the Russian regime. Now, Marxism-Leninism is their theory, and I think it served them well. But, for example, in the United States, Marxism Jeffersonianism should be the theory, and it's wrong to copy one country's experience. Marxism-Leninism applies to Russia, and I was for it, supported it. But to do it in Czechoslovakia, to do it in England, to do it in France, and so on, that's a mistake. You have to set up regimes that conform to the experience and history and the customs and culture of the peoples of those countries, even though you collectivize the economy. Actually, I have recently been thrown into considerable doubt about this whole question. It needs a careful study. In the present consolidation of trusts, where one trust, one economy, let us say, for example, oil, has an $80 billion consolidation. Now, what's the difference between that and what the Soviet Union did? When I was there in 75, we went there because of my wife's pressure. She said, no one can accept your judgment of anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union unless you write it from there, not saying it here in the United States. So we went. And I wrote, in my book is published in 72, I wrote at considerable length about the national interests of communism as against other communism in some countries as against other communisms in other countries. In fact, in 68, China had, I thought with justice, experienced losses because they were copying the Soviet Union, that they ordered the Russian technicians and so on and so forth the hell out of China, and struck out on an adaptation of communism to the Chinese history and experiences and culture and so on and so forth. Each country must have its own people's interests involved, and to determine what structure their political role should take. And we have to re-examine that whole question. I think if I were in the Soviet Union, I was in the Soviet Union three times, and to a total of 3.5 years. So I know the Soviet Union fairly well. And in my opinion, the best thing the Russians can do is to hold public meetings where they re-examine their history in post-World War II experience and what they did and why it didn't work and so on and so forth. And publicly, they must publicly do that so as to be sure that the discussions are democratic and get all views possible. And I think the reason why, one of the reasons why they failed is that they copied the Russians' experience too much. Stalin was a little doubtful about that. One day we were having dinner at his house, and he said to me, you know, everybody thinks I'm a Russian. I'm not a Russian, I'm a Georgian. And Georgians are to Russians somewhat like Mexicans are to the United States. They have different languages, they have different religions, they have different experiences, and one of the reasons why they failed in this period was they didn't take into consideration the national experience of the peoples of these various countries, Czechoslovakia, for example, and all these other countries. Stalin had many thoughts about that, and he was afraid that if he would speak out about them, it would create dissension. And so he didn't speak out about it, but he spoke to me about it, and I agree with him, and I have since turned over in my own mind why they're having trouble over there, and I think that's one of the reasons.
Sam, this is not really a question, but more of a comment. In other words, I guess what I'm hearing you say is that instead of uniting the people under a common cause, they actually, the Soviet system as it operated in the Soviet Union and the different satellite nations that were part of that system, it alienated those people because it ignored their cultural identity.
Yes, I think that's true. That thought has to be elaborated more to take other factors into consideration. But in my book, I wrote this. I described, for example, why the Soviet Union was having trouble with Albania in trying to settle the post-war structures. But just copying the Soviet Union is a mistake. For example, the American people could... The Russians have had for centuries an authoritative experience with a single ruler. The United States didn't. The United States has conflicts and debates from one administration to another and so on. And Leninism would not apply to the United States. You couldn't enforce it on the people.
It's hard to imagine that you'd ever get to a point where you can even try seriously. I agree with you about taking into account the national feelings and the diverse cultures that are represented by our diverse world. I'm just wondering whether there are some key and central ideas that you don't compromise with in socialism. I mean, socialism and communism is one form of socialism, really goes way, way back. I mean, goes back thousands of years. It's a certain attitude towards the world. It's a certain attitude towards land, towards property, towards your fellow human beings. And that central idea involves viewing resources, viewing the earth as sort of a legacy passed on from one individual to another, not the monopoly of individuals, of any one or two people, or of a corporation, right? Isn't that part of socialism and the socialism?
Yes,
socialist
I
ethic?
Think so.
Right.
You know, when I used to walk around the Comintern building, and after a speech by Stalin, I would hear Russian people mimic Stalin's delivery, because not that he spoke bad Russian, but his intonation was Georgian, and they couldn't accept that annoyed them. And in the Ukraine particularly, they were very strong anti-Russian. They said that Stalin is appointing, or the Central Committee is appointing, all Russians to preside over the Ukrainians, and they were hostile to that.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that has to be re-examined, and I won't presume to re-examine it for them. I think they must hold public meetings and debate these questions publicly so that the feelings of the people are taken into account.
Mm-hmm. But that's a little tough now, because the feelings of the people are sort of reflected through the mass media and manipulated by the mass media, and it's very hard to know when people are feeling their feelings, or when it's being manipulated and translated by other people. And even elections now, I don't know if how you feel about elections today, whether you feel they're truly democratic institutions or what. Maybe we can talk about what has happened to American capitalism. We've talked about changes in American socialism and communism, but can a people really make its feelings known today?
Well, of course, you're right about that. For example, the owners of the television stations are all big capitalists, quite clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And their attitude towards Clinton is dictated by their own self-interest. I think Clinton has been a good president. But I don't mean I agree with everything he's done, but surely I don't agree with his moral lack of scruples. But I don't even agree with his relations with other countries. Sometimes, I see the world is drifting towards a three centers of power. One is the European community, in which the Germans and the British will argue out their who dominates. And I think the British have had their day, and the Germans will take over. The other is the Pacific Coast, Pacific Ocean countries, what they call the Rim countries, where Japan takes over. Japan now is running. We buy cars that are made in Korea, but they're made by the Japanese, and that is a second power. And the third power is the Western Hemisphere, where I think we have to be careful for the sake of the American people that our interests are protected. And I don't think Clinton is fully aware of that.
I guess Sam.
On the other hand, he is conscious of the need for peaceful settlement of these questions. We have a Monroe Doctrine, for example, and when the British sent two warships to shoot up the Falkland Islands. Now, the Falkland Islands are sheep country. And what the hell do the British need the Falkland Islands? They needed them for military bases. That's what they needed them for, to reassert what they lost in Chile, for example, whose economy they used to dominate. And we let those warships come in without so much as a protest under the Monroe Doctrine. And I think Clinton isn't aware of that. I don't think he understands that question very well. Nevertheless, I think he's been a good president. And
Well, you'd get an argument from me on that, Sam.
Oh, yes, I'm sure I would.
Well, listen, I wanted to break in here for just a minute. You mentioned protecting our interests, and I guess I would also, as a working person and a union person, say that I guess that's where my argument would come in against Clinton, that his policies and the general policies of the United States for quite some time, and I guess I would go all the way back much longer than we need to talk about this morning. But I guess, Sam, my question is, from a working person's perspective, what interests are we protecting?
Well, you're right to ask that question. That's a very important question. You're absolutely right. But I've given up hope of getting a president outside of Sam Darcy who would agree with all the thoughts I have. And even though I endorse Clinton, I don't think everything he decides is correct, but I carefully weigh two things. One is maybe he knows something I don't know, and maybe he deliberately favors the things that I disagree with. I think he's the best we can get at the moment. I don't know of anyone else. One day after the last election, we had a meeting in, we didn't have a meeting. We had, we were invited to a doctor who specializes in hearing problems. And when I came in, which was late in the day, this doctor and who was the vice president who ran for office in the last election? At any rate, he was supported by the communists and all of those others against my judgment. And the doctor and several other people were sitting together. And when I came in, I heard the vice president say, who was supposed to be a left guy, say, I'm trying to think of the exact words, and I'm not succeeding. He said, the author, the dramatic author who had a number of progressive plays on Broadway, she said, she had said that, I guess I'm the only author, the only playwright who has three failures on Broadway at once. And this vice president said, well, he said, times being what they are, you should be happy that you have three failures on Broadway. And I got burnt up with that, and I scolded him. I said, if you're defeated, as he was defeated very badly, if you're defeated, then you must, if you're big enough, you sit down and you say, what mistakes have I made? And then work out the mistakes. And he didn't answer me. He just looked embarrassed.
Do you think that socialism or communism can work out its mistakes today?
I hope so. I hope that's why I'm advocating that they have public meetings where they discuss what went wrong. Because I know the Russian people fairly well. I know the Russian people and the Ukrainian people as much as you can know from 3.5 years of living with them. And I think that they have many highly intelligent people amongst them. And if they have public discussions like that, then maybe they'll come out with solutions. There's no guarantee, of course.
Sam, I was interested to know what your thoughts are after having spent time in the Soviet Union concerning how workers' rights were protected or not protected under that system when you experienced it during the 30s.
Well, I can tell you in 75 particularly, I found Stalin had told me once before, previous trip, that his speeches are misunderstood because they think he's scolding the people for not doing this or that or the other thing. And he said he wasn't scolding the people. He was scolding the growing bureaucracy, which I think he realized is a menace to the future of the Soviet Union. And I believe that that's a very important thing. One of the things I like about our country, one of the many things I like about our country, is that discussion is relatively free, not altogether free, but relatively free. And the president probably knows some things that I don't know that determined his opinion. And I believe that when we talk about democracy, that's what we mean, that the consensus of opinion is available. Not perfectly, but it's available. And out of such discussion, the creative initiative of the population would help our country prosper.
I guess maybe one of the problems we have is that in the representative government system that we've established, we have majority rule, which, in my opinion, very often favors the, well, it certainly favors the moneyed interests, but it also favors the kind of the bully interests wherever the political factions develop. And I don't think we have much consensus in this country anymore.
Well, I think you're right about the many things along that line, but it's the best we can get. I mean, the people who run the let me give you some experiences I've had. WOR and ABC at two different times sent a crew to interview me in New Jersey, and once in here in Margate in Florida. And when it was over, that there was they must have gone to a lot of expense to, because they brought in equipment and for photography and all kinds of stuff. And when it was over, the lady who came from WOR, I said to her, "How do you think it went?" She said, "Terrific." She said, "It's the best I've ever had." Now, some months later, Columbia University invited me to judge a picture which one of their people made about the South. And there were quite a number of people invited, maybe 30 or 40. And I went, and among them, it turned out that the lady from WOR was present, and she came up to me and said what my opinion was of the picture and so on. And I asked her, "I haven't seen this interview or heard this interview that you filmed, and what's the problem?" She says, "The problem is that you were too fair, F-A-I-R, with the people they disapprove of."
Sam, we actually have a caller who wants to ask some questions, okay? I'm going to put
sure.
him on the line. You're on the line.
Yes, hi. I have a question for Sam.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask a couple of questions regarding how he feels about capitalism presently. A couple of questions are, how does he feel about multinational corporations, which seem to be moving along nicely with the blessing of President Clinton and our Congress? And how does he feel about unions becoming less strong, and also the fact that it needs, nowadays, we need two people in families to work rather than just one? So those are some questions I have for Sam.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm not sure I understood the question, but the question is the evils of capitalism.
Or multinational capitalism.
Huh?
Multinational corporations.
Yes. That's a very interesting question that needs a lot of discussion. But I have wondered whether the population is happier over a under a bureaucracy which really was evil in the Soviet Union, which was arbitrary and a lot of people feathering their nests and all of that, or are they better off, or are they no worse off, let's put it that way, under a merger system which is going on now, in which merger industry after industry gets merged into a monopoly? I'm not sure of that. I have to work that out in my mind. But as long as we have democracy, I hope we can discuss that and elect representatives. I'm fully aware of the problems of electing representatives. You need so much money, and but as some democracy, if we have some democracy, there's hope for correcting it.
But isn't there a third way or a fourth way, Sam? I mean, you're giving sort of this dual. That's not the only choice, right?
No, it's not the only choice. There are other choices, and the other choices all derive from what is the best way in which we can serve the American people without impinging on the welfare of people of other countries.
Mm-hmm. Caller, are you still there?
Yes, I am. I guess my next question, I just have one other question. The power of the electoral process, or is there another way that there should be change in this country? And that's my last question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure, thanks.
Yes, for example, I think in the elections, the people with the most money or the people who are favored most by the owners who have the most money make the decisions. And I read every day, I read quite a few papers and debates and so on. And I see they say something that looks very attractive in many instances. Very attractive, but hidden behind this glowing promise of John Doakes, somebody running for office, is a phony, because there are other questions involved. In other words, we have reached a point where the people with money have their way and control the media and so on. And what's the answer to that? The answer to that is, of course, to organize people you can trust. That sounds very imperfect and no solution at all. But I can't think of any other solution except democracy and continue broadening the democracy.
Yeah, I I think broadening the democracy, Sam, is really the question that we need to address. And I think broadening the democracy has to involve some kind of redistribution of wealth. And, of course, from my perspective, I say it has to start by organizing from the workplace, certainly. And I don't see any other way to do it, because that's where the control takes place. If we fold our arms, we can stop it all right now, but we haven't been able to convince ourselves collectively to do that.
Well, even that presents a problem. For example,
certainly does.
There's a quite large union, 58,000 members in New York State, which is in trouble. They have many grievances and so on. And amongst them is a grievance of severance pay. In other words, when a person gets fired or quits or something like that, if he's in the directorate, he'll get $2-3 million. But if he's a humble worker in the shop, he's lucky if he gets a $10 bill. Now, the question, I wrote a proposal for them that so much money has to be set aside in the operation of all of these companies for severance pay, and the committee that that awards severance pay has to be a democratic committee that is elected by workers and elected by management and so on and so forth. And the checks to issue severance pay have to be signed by a designee of the employees. Now, when this was submitted to the union officials, they said, "Oh, this is too radical. We couldn't achieve that." Well, I didn't want to cause any dissension, so I just pulled my ears in. But the point is that the path towards a greater democracy is not an easy one. It's a very difficult one.
Yeah, you're speaking to a greater problem as to how the unions are actually set up in legislation and so forth. But I guess we don't have time to talk about that anymore today.
Sam, we only have about 1 minute left, so I'm going to go out with some music, but I want to thank you for coming on the air, and we'd like to probably bring you back sometime and continue this conversation.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
And this is, you're listening to Capital District Progressive Radio on WRPI Troy 91.5 FM. And on the air has been Sam Darcy, former Communist Party USA District Organizer, National Education Director, was a member of the National Committee, head of the International Labor Defense, and also a member of the Communist International. And we've been talking about the Communist Manifesto, communism, and where it stands in our world today, and a lot of other things, too, in the past 2 hours. Right now, we're going to go out with Billy Bragg with the International and go right into Democracy Now! You're listening to WRPI Troy. Sam, stay on the line.
Hard to your possessions, for you have nothing.